The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning. And welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We're a Unitarian Universalist congregation dedicated to nurturing the spirit and transforming the world. I'm Preston Lutweiler, President of the Board of Trustees, and I want to personally welcome you this morning, all of you who are here in the sanctuary and those of you who are on Zoom. Wherever you are on your life journey, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, whomever you love, whatever your gender, identity, or expression, we welcome you into our ever-expanding circle of compassion and caring. Our service today will be about Earth Day and our seventh UU principle, which calls on us to affirm and promote respect for the interdependent web of all existence. So we'll start with the chalice lighting. Linda Weaver will light the chalice with words from Rachel Carson.
So for all of you who may not be familiar with Rachel Carson, our youngsters will be educating us about her shortly, and I'll need helpers for that. Okay, so these are words from her writings. We now stand where two roads diverge. But unlike the roads in Robert Frost's familiar poem, they are not equally fair. The road we've been traveling is deceptively easy, a smooth superhighway on which we progress with great speed. But at its end lies disaster. The other fork of the road, the one less traveled by, offers our last, our only chance to reach a destination that assures the preservation of the earth. Those who dwell among the beauties and mysteries of the earth are never alone or weary of life. Those who contemplate the beauty of the earth find reserves of strength that will endure as long as life lasts. The more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders and realities of the universe, the less taste we have for destruction. Just a little technical question. I didn't know if I was supposed to read and light or just read and someone else lit.
Often you learn for it. Well, we do in your intro.
Okay.
And now
we will light the peace lamp, and please repeat after me. May peace be with us.
Now we'll play the gathering song, Morning Has Broken by Cat Stevens. The words will appear in the video. And please sing along as you're willing and able, but remain seated so the people behind you can see the lyrics.
Mine is the sunlight, mine is the morning, born of the one light, Eden saw play. Praise with elation, praise every morning, God's recreation of the new day. Morning has broken like the first morning, blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from the world.
And now I would like you all to join me with a responsive reading of Prayers of the People from the 1990 UN Environmental Sabbath Service. Please respond with the words that will appear in bold on the screen. To bring new life to the land, to restore the waters, to refresh the air. To renew the forests, to care for the plants, to protect the creatures. To celebrate the seas, to rejoice in the sunlight, to sing the songs of the stars. To recall our destiny, to renew our spirits, to reinvigorate our bodies. To recreate the human community, to promote justice and peace, to remember our children. We join together as many and diverse expressions of one loving mystery for the healing of the earth and the renewal of all life. And now, Linda Weaver will lead us in a moment for all ages with the kids.
Today's book is called Rachel Carson and Her Book That Changed the World. So today we're going to read about a really famous person. Oh, here's something. Let's get something for Lucas. If he wants to shake this, he can. We'll see how that goes. Okay. And it's by Lori Lawler. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Rachel Carson, we hope that you will be by the end of the book, right, guys? And the pages I'm reading from will appear up on the screen. Early one morning in May 1922, oh my gosh, do you know how long ago that was? I mean, like, I wasn't even born then. That's how long ago it was. Yeah. I mean,
it was over a century ago.
What year is it now? It's
2023. That was over a century ago.
It was over a century ago. Can you imagine? Young Rachel Carson discovered a secret place deep in the woods, fragrant with pine needles. Witchity, 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 called a yellow throat. Rachel followed the chanting wild bird up and down the hills along the Allegheny River. Does anyone know what state the Allegheny River's in? You could say it.
Yeah.
It's in PA. It's in Pennsylvania. It's out near Pittsburgh, where she was born. Not stopping until she came upon its nest hidden in a bush. Closer, closer she crept. Click. Her camera captured four eggs, mottled white and brown, precious as shining fruit. So what do we know about Rachel right now? What did she like to do? Yeah, she liked to take pictures, and she liked to be where?
In nature.
In nature, great. All her life, Rachel Carson was curious and determined. She was born on May 27, 1907, on the outskirts of Springdale, a small town in Pennsylvania. Since her brother and sister were much older and neighborhood children seldom came to visit, Rachel often went on her own to explore her family's 65 acres of woods, orchards, and fields. It's a lot of, you're right, it's a lot of land. Her doting mother also loved nature. She taught Rachel to sky watch on starry nights and how to recognize the haunting melody of a wood thrush. Rachel read constantly and worked hard in school. Quick question. How many of you work hard in school? Come on, be honest. I know that. And how many of you are thinking about working hard in school, right, Lucas? Rachel read constantly, and that's probably why she was so smart. When she was only 11, her story about a brave pilot won a prize and was published in St. Nicholas Magazine for Children. She decided to become a writer. Times were tough. Rachel's father struggled to make a living as a traveling salesman. Her fiercely proud mother doubled her number of piano students and sold apples, chickens, even the family china, to help send Rachel to Pennsylvania College for Women, later named Chatham College in Pittsburgh. Academic scholarship in hand, Rachel climbed into a borrowed Model T and said goodbye. College was a new world for shy Rachel. While she enjoyed her writing classes, she felt awkward at parties and dances. When everyone else dressed up to go to a concert at Carnegie Music Hall, Rachel slipped away to study stuffed birds at a nearby natural history museum. Social life did not improve when Rachel's stern-faced mother appeared on campus nearly every weekend to type Rachel's papers. I know we have some folks here that have kids in college, and I don't think they're appearing at campus every weekend, are they? Okay. That summer when Rachel came home after her first year at college, a putrid smell lingered everywhere. What's putrid mean? It means what? It's pollution. It's really, does it smell good or bad? Really bad, right. Smoke clouded the sky. Pollution floated on the river. The woods were being cut down for factories and houses. Too many quarreling people crowded her family's cramped houses. Her parents, her poverty-stricken brother and his wife and yowling baby, her divorced sister and her two mischievous toddlers. Even with a tent pitched in the front yard, there was scarcely room for everyone. Where could Rachel go to escape? All this filled her with sadness and worries about the environment and her own future. When she returned to college, a biology class taught by Miss Mary Scott Skinker changed her life. At a time when few women pursued her careers in science, Rachel made up her mind to become a biologist. There was so much she wanted to learn about animals and plants. She knew she could find a way to pay for graduate school. Sure enough, she won a full scholarship to Johns Hopkins University. So Rachel, she was born in a time where women couldn't even vote. So think about that. And later achieved the right to vote. So women weren't going into science in areas that were largely reserved for men. The summer before she started graduate school, 20-year-old Rachel traveled to Woods Hole, Massachusetts to study at a marine biology lab. When she stood beside the Atlantic Ocean for the first time, she lost her heart to a world of restless water and sky. Surf crashed, seabirds called, a briny smell filled the air, mysterious creatures scuttled in tide pools. What life hid below the ocean waves? So I'm going to synopsize this a little bit and say she finished college. She got her master's degree, which only a handful of women had. And then the Great Depression came, and there was lots of unemployment, and nobody wanted to hire her. So when her dad died, she was only 28 years old, and she had to support her family. She took part-time jobs teaching and writing newspaper articles to pay for groceries. She reached out to her teacher, remember Miss Skinker, whose name I could not pronounce right? That she reached out to her, and she took an exam for a government job, and she aced it. That means she got it. It was perfect. She got a perfect score. She did not give up. She kept knocking on doors and sending out letters. And so you can shake your tambourine so we know the next page. One day, the chief of the Bureau of Fisheries interviewed Rachel. "Sorry, no jobs," he told her. Maybe she'd be interested in trying to fix dull radio scripts about sea life. Every other writer had tried and failed. So she started ghostwriting for the Bureau of Fisheries. And finally, she landed a full-time job as a biologist, one of only two professional women on the staff. Her boss read her lengthy work and handed it back to her with a twinkle in his eye. He said, "I don't think it will do. Better try again, but send this one into The Atlantic," which is a very famous magazine and is still being published today. She followed his advice, and when the magazine printed Undersea, Rachel was approached by an editor from a book publisher. Why not write about the sea for ordinary readers? So her first published book, it was in 1941, it was Under the Sea, a Naturalist Picture of Ocean Life. But that was just as Pearl Harbor in Hawaii was bombed and America became involved in World War II. The book, almost unnoticed, quickly disappeared from bookstore shelves. But she did not stop researching and writing. "Once you're aware of the wonder and beauty of Earth," she scribbled in her journal, "you will want to learn about it." As a biologist for 15 years, she went to places where few women ventured. She went to Nova Scotia. She observed reef animals in a special suit with an 84-pound diving helmet off the coast of Florida. And she tracked alligators atop a rumbling glades buggy in a swampy Florida Everglades. Yeah. Meanwhile, she worked on her own writing in the evening and on weekends. She began to notice disturbing trends. What happened to the web of life? Remember the web of life? That's one of our UU principles. The web of life, that means everything's interconnected and everything works together. What happened to the web of life when more and more garbage was dumped into the ocean? How did rising ocean temperatures affect living creatures? In 1951, she published a bestseller, The Sea Around Us. A year later, she quit her job to write full time. During the next 3 years, she researched and wrote The Edge of the Sea. She was well known, so well known that people demanded her autograph in elevators, beauty parlors, taxi cabs, and restaurants. Okay, next page. Okay, come on. Rachel never married. Not only was she the sole breadwinner, she was also responsible for the care of many different family members when they were unemployed, ill, or dying. At age 50, she adopted her niece's 5-year-old son, Roger. Now she faced the challenge of taking care of a wild young boy and finding time to write. None of you were wild when you were 5, were you? Maybe.
Corinne was.
Oh, Corinne, were you a little wild? Corinne said, "Yeah, I own that. That's good. I don't want to out anybody." And Lucas, you're not wild, are you? Are you a wild boy? A little wild? Yeah. Oh, look, he's showing me a little wild. Okay. As always, the outdoors were her refuge. So in other words, when things got really tough, she went outside and she appreciated nature. She bought a few acres of land along the beloved Maine coast and built a summer cottage. At night, during low tide, she took a flashlight and went along the rocky shore. She rolled up the legs of her pants and wriggled on her stomach, discovering big scurrying crabs, starfish, and anemones. But in 1958, she began a difficult new project. When World War II ended, the chemical industry in the United States had become very powerful. Heavy spraying of chemicals to kill insects was done routinely in parks and nature preserves, even in swimming pools and on crowded city streets. As early as 1945, Rachel had read about studies of declining bird populations across the country. Each year, researchers reported fewer nesting and migrating birds. The more she investigated, the more alarmed she became. Insecticides were deadly to birds, insects, fish, and other animals. Hey, what about people? No one had taken a stand against big business. Federal agencies that approved chemical use or universities that perform shoddy research about the effects of chemicals. She knew she was walking into dangerous territory. However, because she had no connection with industry, government, or any university, she felt she could gather facts more freely. People would read what she wrote and fight to demand clean air, clean water. Okay, we're turning the page. Okay. Only Rachel's closest friends knew she was in a race against time. In 1960, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Her book, Silent Spring, was something she believed in so deeply. Nothing made me ever consider turning back. She worked for 4 years to complete Silent Spring. Her careful research about insecticides was slow. Her writing and rewriting was even slower. She wanted to create a book that everyone, not just scientists, could understand. In spite of being bedridden with illness and exhaustion, she refused to give up. You can show them Silent Spring if you want to. Did you? Show them again. Hold it up real high so everybody can see it. That's her book. So in spite of being bedridden, oh, I read that. I can never again listen happily to a thrush song. That's a bird song, she explained, if I had not done all I could. In 1962, Silent Spring was published and became a bestseller. The book created a firestorm of criticism from the chemical industry. Congress held hearings, investigations followed, new laws were written. And I'm going to just throw this in as a memory that I have. They worked very hard to discredit her and said very bad things and untrue things about her because they didn't want anyone to believe what she was saying. Rachel did not live to see the many positive environmental changes created by so many ordinary people inspired by her brave book. On April 14, 1964, just before an early spring sunset filled with birdsong, 56-year-old Rachel died. So we have this book, if anyone wants to take it and read it for your kiddos, but we also have this copy of her book, if anyone would be interested in taking that and reading it as well. So Jerry, will you help us sing our youngsters out with our processional, please?
So yesterday, April 22nd, was Earth Day. And our UU 7th principle says that we covenant and affirm to respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, very much like the message of Rachel Carson's book. Earth Day and the environmental movement that is set in motion were very much in line with our 7th principle. We trace our UU lineage back to transcendentalists like Ralph Waldo Emerson, arguably one of the first naturalists and first environmentalists. So did you use champion Earth Day? Did we push it forward with our 7th principle? Well, no, actually the first Earth Day was in 1970 and our 7th principle came about in 1985, 15 years later. So I'm gonna go through the history of both Earth Day and our UU 7th principle. What prompted the first Earth Day? Well, you heard about Rachel Carson's book, but there was something that came before that, and there were several things that came before that and after that really culminated in Earth Day. In late October of 1948, air pollution killed 20 people and sickened thousands in Donora, Pennsylvania, which was not far from where Rachel Carson grew up. This was one of the worst air pollution disasters in US history. 14 years later, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, which you just heard about, was published in 1962. And it documented the effects of DDT and our industrialized society in general and our government. DDT was very useful in killing mosquitoes, and in controlling typhoid fever, but was used so freely that it was decimating populations of insects and birds. Oil spills fouled beaches. Millions of cars spewed toxic lead from the air from leaded gasoline. Tetraethyl lead, which is where the gasoline the leaded gasoline comes from, was developed as a chemical warfare agent, but was found to be more useful in reducing knocking.
It's pollen, folks. It gets both of us. Sorry.
Sorry. Part of the natural web of life. So we were poisoning ourselves and our environment to have smoother running cars. That was the ethos back then. Silent Spring was a clarion call warning that we were poisoning ourselves and our planet, both with leaded gasoline, but more importantly with herbicides and pesticides and oil spills. The book sold more than 500,000 copies in 24 countries and raised public awareness and concern for living organisms, the environment, and the links between pollution, public health, and environmental health. So the next thing that happened 7 years later was an oil spill in an oil well field offshore of Santa Barbara. There's Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, Lompoc, San Luis Obispo, see Pismo Beach. The oil made it all the way up to Pismo Beach. 2 years ago, Linda and I took a trip up the coast of California from San Diego all the way to San Francisco, and we stayed in Santa Barbara at the Ritz-Carlton, and we could see out in the ocean oil well platforms, which was a little surprising. We didn't even know that they were there. And then we drove up to Pismo Beach, which is an overwintering ground for monarch butterflies. It's a long drive, and for the oil to have gotten all the way up there was pretty amazing. So this oil spill released 100,000 barrels, not gallons, barrels of oil into the Pacific Ocean and along the coast. It was the largest oil spill in US history. And it has since been superseded by the Exxon Valdez and by the Deepwater Horizon spills, but this was a big one. Next slide. Okay, it was big enough that President Richard Nixon visited the beach on March 21st, 1969. About 3 months later. And here's what he said when he was visiting the beach. He told the crowd, "The Santa Barbara incident has frankly touched the conscience of the American people." And he said he would do better on environmental policy. And he mentioned that he would consider a halt to all offshore drilling. Well, on April Fool's Day, 1969, he changed his mind and offshore drilling was okay. So people weren't real happy with that. A junior senator from Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson, had witnessed the effects of the oil spill in January, and he announced to the media the idea of teach-ins on college campuses. He enlisted Pete McCloskey, a conservative-minded Republican congressman, to serve as co-chair, and they recruited a young activist, Dennis Hayes, a 25-year-old student, next slide, from the Harvard Kennedy School. Hayes had dropped out after a semester at Harvard to organize the campus teach-ins, and the organizers chose April 22nd, a weekday falling between spring break and final exams, to maximize student participation. So if you want to know why Earth Day is on April 22nd, that's why. They wanted to get as many students out as possible. Well, Hayes built a staff of 85 people to promote events all across America. The effort grew to include many other organizations besides colleges, and the name was changed from a teach-in to Earth Day. And then the idea really caught on. Groups that had been fighting individually against oil spills, polluting factories, power plants, raw sewage, toxic dumps, pesticides, freeways, and the loss of wilderness and extinction of wildlife all united around Earth Day, Support came from Republicans and Democrats, rich and poor, urban dwellers and farmers, business and labor leaders. Thousands of colleges and universities organized protests. There were massive rallies in cities, towns, and communities all across the United States. 20 million Americans, at the time, 10% of the US population, took to the streets, parks, auditoriums, college campuses, and town squares to demonstrate against the impacts of rapacious industrialization, which left a growing legacy of impacts on the environment and human health. Richard Nixon and Congress saw the power of this movement. By the end of 1970, the first Earth Day had led to the creation of the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and the National Environmental Education Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and the Clean Water Act, all in 1 year. 1 year later, Dr. Seuss wrote The Lorax. The book was made into an animated movie in 1972, and that same year, Congress passed the Clean Water Act, and it also banned DDT. In 1973, Congress passed the Endangered Species Act, and in 1975, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, known as FIFRA. Together, all of these laws have protected millions of people from disease and death and hundreds of species from extinction. So I ask, what were you doing on the first Earth Day in 1970? Some of you weren't born yet, but most of you were. And I know I'd like to hear from some of you. And we have one person here who I'm going to bring the mic to, who has a very clear recollection of what she was doing on the first Earth Day. I had left Cornell University after a year in the College of Engineering and half a year in the College of Arts and Sciences. I was working as a laborer, carpenter for a local builder, and had moved into an old war housing development in Bucks County that had become a slum. And I considered myself an environmentalist, but also a social justice and peace activist protesting against the Vietnam War and the injustices of poverty. So if you remember back there, there were lots of protests going on, and a lot of them were about the war in Vietnam, not just the environment. And I really don't remember much about the first Earth Day because I was involved in a lot of other things. But we have somebody here who does. Sunika, would you like to share with us what you were doing on the first Earth Day?
Actually, I wanted to tell you the story that happened much earlier. I was about 12 years old and in Finland. And in school, we had we were taught about the hygiene and so forth. So what I was about 12 years old, and so what went into my head? Yes, we have to wash everything and do this, and you know, boil everything, and so okay, and boil.
Zoom here.
Yeah, boil everything. So I went home, and nobody was home. My parents ran home at the time, and I took everybody's toothbrushes and boiled them. I think I have hated plastic ever since. So anyway, I say Europeans actually are very organized in the sense that how to. When I go to Finland, bio waste, and they have the plastic waste, and they have cardboard and everything, and everybody follows it. They do it. And so, and here, it still needs to be a lot of design. I don't buy plastic as much as I can. I keep in my car a plastic dish in case I go to the restaurant. They don't give me those foam packages. I was doing my own dish and things like that. Anyway, when the first Earth Day came about, I was elated. I really was. And so, to the extent that I bought the newspaper and got myself in a newspaper and my family and so on. But we got to get there somehow. So, because someday, everything will be lost.
And Sonika has copies of the newspaper article in which she appeared on the first Earth Day. So if you'd like to see them out in the lobby, it's pretty interesting. She was a crusader. So that brings us to the UUA and our seventh principle. What was the UUA doing in 1970? Well, we knew they didn't have the seventh principle yet. Actually, the Unitarians and the Universalists had just merged in 1961. And if you can bring the next slide up, Mike, these were the principles around which they gathered and merged. And I've highlighted some key things on here. It was to strengthen one another in a free and disciplined search for truth and foundation, truth as the foundation of our religious fellowship, cherish and spread the universal truths taught by the great prophets and teachers of humanity in every age and tradition, immemorially summarized in the Judeo-Christian heritage as love to God and love to man, to affirm, defend, and promote the supreme worth of every human personality, the dignity of man, and the use of the democratic method in human relationships, to implement the vision of one world by striving for a world community founded on the ideals of brotherhood, justice, and peace, to serve the need of member churches and fellowships, to organize new churches and fellowships, and to extend and strengthen our liberal religion, and to encourage cooperation with men of goodwill in every land.
So we could do whatever we wanted, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So obviously there was no seventh principle, and the words that I highlighted on this slide were actually so controversial that it almost derailed the merger of the Unitarians and the Universalists. And so they had long discussions, and a compromise version of this was hammered out in an all-day, all-night parliamentary negotiation and debate. Does that sound familiar? Is that where we're headed with our second Article 2 of our bylaws? I don't know. But after that whole all-day negotiating session, they changed the word our, which was in the original, to the Judeo-Christian tradition. That's what they argued about all day and all night, and that was the resolution, and the two denominations came together over this. But like good UUs, they kept talking and they kept arguing, and finally in 1985, they came up with some new principles. These are the new ones, soon to be maybe changed, I don't know. It says, we, the member of the Congregation of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process with our congregations and society and in society at large, and the goal of world community in peace, liberty, and justice for all. And here we go, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Finally, our seventh principle. Now, what'd they do with all that Judeo-Christian stuff, you know? They have six sources, and these are in addition to the seven principles. So just in case you're concerned that we have left our Judeo-Christian, it's in here somewhere. Direct experience, words and deeds of prophetic women and men. So they were finally getting it, right? Wisdom of the world's religions, Jewish and Christian teachings, humanist teachings, and spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. So that last principle kind of fits in with our seventh principle in the first list. So we can be proud of our UU seventh principle, calling on us to respect the interconnected web of life of which we are all a part. But we should remember that there were people on this land, this very spot, that lived in harmony with, respected, and worshiped the interconnected web of life of which they were all a part. And they took from the environment only what they needed. And for them, that was enough. And it sustained them and the environment for more than 10,000 years. To put that in some perspective, you may remember the story of John Murray and Thomas Potter. John Murray, who landed in Good Luck, New Jersey by mistake on September 30th, 1770, and was urged to give his first sermon by Thomas Potter. And so began the religion of universalism in America. That was 200 years before the first Earth Day. The shad and sturgeon still ran in the Delaware in the spring. Bald eagles were sufficiently abundant to choose as the national symbol over the objection of Ben Franklin, who favored the turkey. And Pennsylvania's Penn's Woods was covered in forest. Many Lenape still occupied much of the Lenape Hoking, which included most of what is now New Jersey. Over that 200 years, between 1770 and 1970, the blink of an eye compared to the 10,000 years that the Lenape lived on this land, the Lenape were driven from their homelands. Whales were killed and processed for baleen, for corset stays, and for oil, for lamps, and for lubricating machinery. The Atlantic short and short-nosed sturgeon were harvested to the brink of extinction for caviar. American bison were hunted to the brink of extinction for food. The passenger pigeon was hunted into extinction, mostly for sport, not for food. The prairies were cleared and created the Dust Bowl in the drought of the 1930s. Entire forests were cut down for charcoal to make and forge iron. Coal, iron ore, and limestone were mined for steel. Rivers were polluted with sediment, mine waste, and sewage. So we had a lot to make up for in 1970 on the day of the first Earth Day. For 200 years, we had done a lot of damage. The environmental laws, agencies, and ethos that were inspired by the first Earth Day have brought about the banning of DDT, the return of osprey and bald eagles, reforestation of Pennsylvania, air pollution and water pollution controls. Our air is cleaner, our streams, lakes, and rivers are cleaner. We still have a long way to go, but we're experiencing the effects of global warming and climate change. Pesticides are still decimating the honeybee populations, but we're paying closer attention and trying to avoid the mistakes of the last 200 years. And we have more respect for the people who lived on this land over the preceding 10,000 years. Many of us here at Thomas Paine UU Fellowship try to live by our seventh principle. We plant native plants, milkweed for monarch butterflies, trees for birds. Some of us organize stream cleanups. Thank you, John. Some of us drive electric or hybrid vehicles. Some of us avoid eating meat. We recycle, though like true UUs, we often scold and argue about the proper way to do it. We try to live simply. Well, some of us do better at that than others. And we try to live lightly on the land. We could do better, and we as a nation of consumers still have a long way to go. But today, let's celebrate Earth Day and our seventh principle And in a nod to our UU sixth source, worship in the embrace of Gaia, the Greek primordial deity who is the personification of Earth and the mother of all life. Now I'd like you to join us in our hymn. This is hymn number 121, We'll Build the Land, originally written by Carolyn McDade and Barbara Zanotti, and revised and performed here by Mo Mack in concert with John and Cynthia Bowling. The words will appear on slides, so please remain seated so everyone can see the lyrics, but please sing along.
We'll build a land where we bind up the broken. We'll build a land the captives go free, where the oil of gladness dissolves all mourning. We'll build a promised land that can be. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace. Where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever flowing stream. Build a land where we bring the good tidings to all the afflicted and all those who mourn, and we'll give them garlands instead of ashes. We'll build a land where peace is born. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace, where justice shall roll like an ever-flowing stream. We'll build a land where the forests are fertile, where the water and wind run clean and clear, and community matters more than possessions. Come share this land, let's build it right.
And so now we've come to the part in our service, Matters of the Heart, where you may share your thoughts briefly. And Mike will give instructions for that after a brief musical interlude during which you can gather your thoughts and relax and think about what you might want to say. Thank you.
We can bring this time of sharing to a close, and as we often do, we will sing Spirit of Life, and the words will show up here on the screen in the front and on your screen in Zoom momentarily.
I'd like to close with words from an Earth Day worship service by Diana Smith. As we go forth from this sacred space, may we celebrate Earth and our shared lives. May we recognize our connections to all that is in and on Earth. May we truly and deeply value the inherent worth of all in its awesome, interconnected web of existence. May we commit ourselves to a new way. And may we hold our commitments and each other gently, yet firmly. Blessed be, and amen. And we will close with our closing song, one that I think many of you like, Hymn 1064, Blue Boat Home, written and performed by Peter Mayer, after which Linda Weaver will extinguish the chalice and give the announcements.
Thanks to the waves upholding me. hear the great winds urging me on. Greet the infinite sea before me. Sing the sky my sailor's song. I was born upon the fathoms. Never harbor or port have I known. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue.
Okay, and now I will extinguish the chalice with these words. We extinguish the flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we gather again.